I'm Andy Borowitz in for Leonard Lopate, and I guess that's our science music, because the year 2012 was a good one for major advances in science. The Higgs boson was discovered. Love the boson. A new rover landed on Mars, plus new discoveries about our DNA and dark matter in the universe. Well, for this week's Please Explain, Corey Powell, editor-at-large of Discover magazine, joins us to talk about the biggest stories in science and why they matter. Welcome to the Leonard Lopate Show, Corey.
Oh, it's very exciting to be here.
And we're also inviting you, our listeners, to join the conversation. If you have questions about last year's scientific stories, or if you'd like to let us know which you think is most important, or maybe you have a story that we didn't cover that's a great science story, you can call us at 212-433-9692, or you can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. You can also ask a question on Facebook or Twitter. So we have all the social channels completely wide open for you, Corey. That's great. Now, I have to preface this by saying I'm really fascinated by science, but I was a terrible science student. I think I kind of hit the wall in chemistry. So in a way, I'm the perfect interviewer for this segment of Please Explain, because I want you to explain everything to me in the simplest terms possible. Can you think you were up to that challenge?
How much time do I have?
We've got about 40 minutes.
Oh, but yeah. Sure, I can do that.
If you use a lot of simple one-syllable words, we should be cool.
One-syllable words, and I'll speak very quickly.
Okay, good. Well, now, your number one science story of 2012 in Discover magazine, this is no surprise at all, it's the aforementioned Higgs boson. There was so much talk about this when it came out, and we've actually covered it on the show. Leonard's talked about it, but it's obviously a complicated topic and can be a little hard for non-physicists to understand. So can you explain, this was called the God particle, right?
Right.
Was that too much hype? Should we not have called it that? Or?
Well, now to be honest, it actually was a physicist who introduced the term God particle. It was him trying to sell it to the public.
Physicists with their hype.
That's
their
like, exactly. Machine. This is what happens when physicists try to do your job for you. look, God particle is a slightly silly term. I mean, there are two ways of looking at the story. I mean, the one way, which is the way it's typically presented, is a very, very weird story. I mean, here's a particle that lasts one sextillionth of a second. It was created at the Large Hadron Collider by spinning these invisible beams of particles around at nearly the speed of light. It spews out, and it fulfills a 40-year-old theory that says this particle should exist, and this particle fills in a sort of a theoretical framework that explains why matter has mass, why when you sit down you actually feel some weight on your chair, and why the Earth has some weight when it's going around the sun. But this particle is actually the thing that makes every other particle have its heft. So it's a pretty cool and pretty weird story.
That's exactly what I thought it was, by the way.
Yes. No. I saw a lot of nodding going on here. Yeah. Of course, the listeners don't know that, but he's just saying, tell me something I don't know.
But wait, I have to just go back for 1 second. You said it lasts 1/16th
One billionth of a trillionth of a second.
What do you mean it lasts so long? It's there and then it's gone?
I'm confused. Yeah, it breaks down. So the process that creates it is there all the time, and the process behind it is what's sort of interacting with you and making you feel heavy. Mm-hmm. But when you actually try to break this particle free to look at it in isolation, it's an incredibly unstable thing. Mm-hmm. And so it falls apart almost instantly, and that's why it takes an incredible amount of energy. And these if you've ever seen pictures of the Large Hadron Collider, these detectors are like, it looks like something that would, they're like cranes that would lift railroads. I mean, it's an enormous piece of machinery, and all of that to detect this tiny particle because it leaves such a little trail.
I'm Andy Borowitz in for Leonard Lopate, and we're talking with Corey Powell, editor-at-large of Discover magazine, for this week's Please Explain. We're talking about the top science stories of 2012 here at WNYC and WNYC.org. Well, I just have a question, which is this thing is around for so little time, and it's so tiny and yet so important. How do we verify that this thing was actually discovered? Because I know if I had been spending my life looking for the Higgs boson, I probably would just one day say, hey, look, I found it, but it's not here anymore, so you just have to take my word for it. But how do we, when you come out with a big discovery like that, what's the verification process? How do we know that the scientists aren't pulling our leg?
Well, that's a good question, because there's only one machine in the world that can find it and that can verify it. So basically the people who created it are the same people who then go back and say, oh, let's double check our work to make sure we're right. Yeah, we're right.
That's the kind of gig I want, where you verify your own work. That's amazing.
And it's done on such a large scale. So this is the Large Hadron Collider. It's an international collaboration. The machine costs about $7 billion to make. It's sort of the place to be if you're in particle physics today. The two papers announcing the discovery of they're not even saying it's 100% sure, but they're the very likely discovery of the Higgs boson. There were 5,100 authors on the paper.
Wow.
It was, I think, 32 pages of just lists of names of the people who worked on the paper. When you ask, who can you go to outside the field to verify this, the answer is nobody.
Right.
Everybody who can do it is there.
Well, now, and the collider is in Switzerland, and obviously it's a gigantic and very expensive, and I presume hard to operate machine. Like, I would not be able to operate the collider.
It probably actually pretty much turns on with a button.
Could do it.
Yeah, the technicians, have nightmares that there will be a coolant leak, or the circuitry will get fried, and there have been technical problems. But once they get everything operating,
it's colliding.
It's like you get in your Toyota Prius, and you don't really need to know how it works. You just hit start.
Oh well, that totally changes my view of how, because I had pretty much checked off super collider operator from my list of career options. So that's good to know that's still open.
No, you just want to be the guy at the top.
You
don't want to be the guy down in the tunnel fixing gaskets.
Well, two questions about this. First of all, what are the other things that they're doing? What other sort of breakthroughs are they looking for with this incredible machine? And I guess I'm a little unclear as to what the discovery of the boson really means for, say, somebody like me. I know that now, I understand now that I have heft, that
right.
This proves why I have matter, and that's cool. But like, what is this going to have any effect? Will this lead to any advances, or is it all just the people in this field are now reassured that their 40-year theory has been confirmed?
Well, yeah. So there's the theoretical physics answer, which is basically, it's an intellectual adventure answer that there's this theory originally developed actually all the way back in the late 60s. It's even more than 40 years. That describes the entire relationship between all the different particles and things that make up you and me and this planet and the universe. And this was sort of the last missing piece of that theory.
Mm-hmm.
And so in that sense, it's almost an undiscovery. It's everybody thought it would be there, and finding it there basically says, hey, yeah, we're right. Everything fits together. What people were really looking for is actually for the stuff that doesn't fit. And so in some sense, it's the discovery that comes right after this that people are really excited about, of the things that look weird, because we know, we're pretty sure that we don't know everything yet.
I'm definitely sure at this point.
And in some ways, it's actually kind of disappointing that this thing kind of looks like what we were expecting.
Right.
The really exciting things are when you realize that you're completely and totally wrong. But, the deeper thrust of your question, from a practical standpoint, why does this matter? The biggest answer is that the kind of physical understanding that you get when you do this type of work, and the kind of engineering problems that you solve, have totally unexpected side effects. Earlier versions of particle accelerators are now used to treat cancer. They're now used to make very high speed computer chips. They relate to nuclear physics that people hope could someday make practical nuclear fusion energy. This knowledge gets distributed in other places, but if you're looking for, if you could control the Higgs boson, what could you do? Honestly, we have no idea. We have no idea.
But just to get back to and then I want to move on to the next story, which is a little bit more tangible.
Yes. but thank you, because it's really hard to hold on to a Higgs boson.
I just keep on saying, please explain.
Yes.
So I just have to know. It was called, as we discussed at the beginning, the God particle. And I seem to remember at the time people saying, well, this will lead to some understanding, or at least some kind of tangible evidence of how everything is created. Is that true, or is that just kind of hype, or does it have anything to do with the way the whole universe began? Or,
well, yeah. So there's this sort of like this great end point of physics that people are working toward. They call a theory of everything.
Mm-hmm.
The idea is that you have one set of equations, and those set of equations tell you, it's the operating manual of how the universe works.
Mm-hmm.
And the ultimate dream is that it tells you that the universe is a rational place. And even more incredibly, what it tells you is that the human brain is capable of understanding the rational basis that the universe operates on. And that,
well, speak for your human brain.
Well,
I
mean,
someone
out there, there is somewhere out there
who
a human
can understand.
Being. Yes, the humanity has been capable of producing that person. You know, even if you and I are sort of operating it, you know, we're kind of like sort of feeding at the crumbs around the bottom of this. Look, the fact that we are able to probe these rules that operate at timescales and at distances that are just incredibly remote from human experience, and that we can actually we can predict subatomic particles, that we can tell the explain the basic rules of how light works, how matter works, how gravity works. When you step back, those are phenomenal things, and really, in the broadest sense, all the technology that we use emerges from that level of understanding.
Okay, let's go to something a little sexier. Not that the Boson isn't sexy, but the Mars rover. It seemed like just very hard upon the discovery of the Higgs boson, we had this other major thing, which is that we landed this this Mars rover, Curiosity,
right?
And that was very exciting. And you had this sort of terrifying landing, and we had the dude with the mohawk at Mission Control that we all saw on Twitter and stuff. What is the significance of this? We've been on Mars before, obviously, with Vera. We've gotten a lot of pictures of Mars. What's different about this rover, and why is this such a big story?
So basically, being realistic, human beings are not going to Mars anytime soon. I think
It takes a long time to get there.
Takes a long time to get there, and it costs a lot of money. And the last time I checked, there was all this stuff going on about government spending. I don't know if you've heard any about this, but apparently people are kind of upset about it.
You know who promised us we were going to go to Mars?
Let's see.
I think George W. Bush.
I think he did
that in a State of the Union address.
George H.W. Bush, I think, also promised that we were going to go to Mars.
And those guys we only got as far as Iraq.
I know.
They both
they took a wrong turn.
I know. Well, half a loaf.
But anyway, so look, let's say for the sake of argument, you're probably not going to be sending human beings in the next 10, 20,
and what
30 years.
Doesn't it take, 3 years to get to Mars?
It's only about 9 months. So,
not so bad.
Yeah, you pack a lot of socks and you're fine.
iPad, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
But there's we have no plans. Are there even any sort of theoretical plans to send a man to Mars?
If you look on the NASA website, you will find a page where there's a formal statement from President Obama saying that NASA is working toward sending humans to an asteroid and then on to Mars. And that's about it. There are no papers. There's no budget. There's no actual plan.
All right. I want to get right back to this to talk about the Mars rover. I'm talking to Corey S. Powell, editor-at-large of Discover magazine, and we're talking about the biggest science stories of 2012 on this week's Please Explain. And if you have a question or a comment, you can give us a call at 212-433-9692. You can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org or find us on Facebook and Twitter. We're going to have more after a break. Later on in the show, George Saunders talks about his latest collection of short stories called 10th of December. Plus, find out why the National Counterterrorism Center has been granted powers that allow it to collect information on Americans even if they're not suspected of a crime. I'm Andy Borowitz, and today for Leonard Lopate, this is WNYC and WNYC.org.
WNYC receives support from New York City Ballet, presenting the Tchaikovsky Celebration, January 15th through February 24th, featuring four programs including nine Balanchine ballets, the Valentino Collaboration, Bal du Couture, and 14 performances of Peter Martin's The Sleeping Beauty. Info at nycballet.com. Verizon, whose corporate responsibility initiatives are dedicated to finding solutions to the world's challenges. More at verizon.com/powerful answers. LV Wood Floors, specializing in custom pre-finished wood flooring and reclaimed wood flooring made to the client's specifications, all sustainably made in the USA. The New York City showroom on 20th Street between 5th and 6th Avenue is open to the public. LVWoodFloors.com.
Director Judd Apatow has had a string of Hollywood successes, but still gets nervous about casting.
I never want to ask anyone that I look up to be in my movie if I don't think it could be as good as their movies. And so that's why I tend to work with young people.
I'm Alec Baldwin. This week on Here's the Thing, Judd Apatow talks about having Adam Sandler as a roommate and watching his wife make out with another guy on film. Listen to my latest show this week at heresthething.org.
Huh. I'm Andy Borowitz in for Leonard Lopate, or WNYC and WNYC.org. And for this week's Please Explain, I'm talking to Corey Powell, editor-at-large of Discover Magazine, about the top science stories of 2012. So we were just rounding the corner to talk about the Mars Curiosity rover. And in what ways is this rover like better than the other rovers we've sent up there? What has it got in it that under the hood that we should be excited about?
Well, I was so what I was getting at before when I was talking about the fact that human beings are not headed to Mars anytime soon. What Curiosity is a very good proxy of a human being, mm-hmm. in a way that the previous rovers were not. So yeah, this thing rolls around kind of the way the other things rolled around, but this thing is has a level of artificial intelligence and a level of scientific sophistication. It's really just fundamentally unlike anything we've ever sent. It's basically a geology lab and a geologist. This thing has the capability. It's got a million watt laser, which sounds very Dr. Evil. it can drill into rocks. It can dig. It can go long distances. And the reason for all of this is that basically this is correct. Sort of a naivete that we used to have, that if you were going to look for life, you just land on Mars and hey, maybe there'd be a tree there, or something would walk by and like, okay, there's life. And what we're realizing now is that if there is life on Mars today, it's probably buried deep underground. Mm-hmm. You probably have to find the right places. Mars is a very desolate location where if any life is hanging on today, it's probably in a very difficult location to find. And so we need to be a lot more sophisticated. But the fundamental truth is still the same. If you found life on a second place in the universe, that would tell you that life. If life happens once, you think it might be a fluke. If it happens twice, it tells you life is probably a generic and common thing. That probably the universe is full of life. And then you can compare: does this thing look anything like life on Earth? Were we completely crazy thinking that our way is the only way that life can be? You would learn an unbelievable amount, and that's why we're going to all this effort, even though you're gonna have a lot of negative results along the way. You're gonna, right. And so there are gonna be a lot of stories of like, we spent another $2 billion and we got a couple more rocks. And I was just on Fox News and I got that question quite aggressively, but.
I don't think they're big fans of science over there at Fox News, though. Well, so give them a break.
Well, but I sort of bristled, and then I thought, it's a completely legitimate question. Right. They here are the American taxpayers saying,
true.
is this just a sort of a playground for scientists to poke at rocks? And I would argue, there's a high risk of failure, but there's also a possibility of a discovery that would be absolutely transformative.
Well, what have we found out so far? What kind of photos or information has the Mars rover sent back?
So, in a sense, we're still really in phase one of the Curiosity mission. The most interesting thing has been that Curiosity found an actual stream bed, proof that there were bodies of flowing water on Mars long ago, and that tells you that conditions really were very Earth-like. That it really, if those were the conditions where life can thrive, those really were there. There are signs of not quite organic chemistry, but pre-organic chemistry, telling you that some of the compounds there, again, were the kinds of things that you would look for if you're looking for the kind of life that we know about. So, this is a mission that's going to be going on for at least another couple of years. It's really only started off to the really geologically interesting parts of the planet. So, in a weird way, what we're seeing is just kind of some snapshots of what lies ahead.
Well, let me ask you about a project that actually Leonard did a Please Explain about this before, and I hope I'm pronouncing this correctly, but you can correct me if I'm not. The Human Microbiome Project, was that right?
Absolutely. Beautiful. say it again. I enjoyed listening.
The Human Microbiome. You see, now I screwed it up because I was under pressure. I was getting a little giddy.
You got cocky.
I got cocky. Yeah. That's right. So tell us about this project, and this is all about microbes, right? Which we sort of grow up, especially in a place like New York City, where there are all these germs everywhere, and people are constantly cleaning their hands and whatever that what do you call that? Purell.
Purell.
Sorry,
yeah, right.
I had a little word retrieval problem there. It's embarrassing, but we're hearing all these sort of negative things about microbes. But are there some good things too that we've been selling microbes short?
Well, so the microbiome project grew out of, really sort of years of quiet research, and we knew that, you know, the human gut is full of bacteria. Mm-hmm. People have known that for a long time. What they didn't really know is what are those things doing there? And, you know, slowly over really just the past few years, people have started to realize that the bacteria in your gut are not just these sort of passive things kind of, you know, feeding off, you know, the leftovers of you know, what your body doesn't digest. These things are actually active participants in what your body does. They actually help you digest. Depending on what kind of mix of microbes you have in your gut can determine whether or not you're susceptible to obesity. Premature babies who are born without acquiring a proper bacteria in their guts have all kinds of health problems. And as disgusting as it sounds, there's a thing called a fecal transplant where you actually introduce feces and all of the bacteria that are in there into premature babies. And now they're actually doing it also for people with colitis who were on heavy antibiotics. It turns out that you really, really, really need those bacteria. And if you don't, your immune system is messed up. Your digestive system is messed up.
Does this have anything to do with probiotics? Is that a different concept?
Please
explain.
Yeah, that's actually it's very much from the same idea. I mean, mm-hmm. the probiotics, you know, I think you know it gets at one bit of that, but it turns out you know it's not one or two things that live in your gut.
Right.
There are thousands of things that live in your gut, and what lives in your gut is as distinctive as your fingerprint. If I went and sequenced what's in your gut, not that I'm about to do it right now, but I could. Your gut looks totally different than my gut. And your gut, you know, a year from now will still look exactly the same as yours, and a year from now mine will look like mine. We each carry our own inner ecosystems, which are distinctively our own, and which are kind of integral to our identity. It's kind of weird, and honestly, people are just now starting to understand it. So the purpose of this project really was just to do a census, just mm-hmm. to even understand what's in there and what is it doing, because potentially there's like a whole new field of medicine of correcting things, not by killing what's inside you, but actually growing the right things inside you.
Does this have anything to do? I remember reading something probably in Science Times earlier this year about the microbe map. Is this related to that in any way?
Yeah. There's a sort of a whole larger trend, which you know it runs actually through our whole issue of the top science stories of the year. There are different types of mapping stories. There are things where basically, you know, we didn't have the kind of sequencing tools and just the data management tools to do these really, really large projects. So there are new maps of how DNA works and new mm-hmm. maps of all the different microbes that live inside you and where they live. Also, you know, different parts of your body have totally different ecosystems. You know, I mean, intuitively, you can imagine, you know, what lives in your eyes is different than, you know, what lives in your groin. You might not think about that, but there it is.
I'd prefer not to.
Yeah, well, it's too late. You're thinking about it right now. And you know, and each of those things is participating in your biology. And here's the really freaky thing. The bacteria and viruses in your body outnumber your cells 10 to 1.
Really?
Yes. You're 90% microbes.
Germ.
And 10% what you think of as you. You're just sort of a rounding error.
When did we figure that out? That seems like a big discovery. That wasn't last year, right? We've known that,
but you know that's actually a statistic that I only really saw for the first time just like 2 or 3 years ago. And I think it is a relatively recent realization of just how profoundly you know our bodies are dominated by these other things.
I'm Andy Borowitz, sitting in for Leonard Lopate here at WNYC and WNYC.org, and I'm talking to Corey Powell, who is the editor-at-large of Discover Magazine, and we're talking about the biggest stories in science from last year. Now, we have a listener in Brooklyn who left this question on our show page. He's not letting you off the hook about the Higgs boson. I just must warn you. Mr. Powell says, I like that sort of accusatory way, Mr. Powell says the Higgs boson lasts for a very short time and then breaks up. But what does it break up into? Good question. What kind of particles make up the particle? Oh, my gosh.
Uh-oh.
Do you have to go to Switzerland to the collider to figure that out, or could you know that off the top of your head?
It breaks down into I cannot tell you offhand, because there's a complicated chain of decay products. And honestly, I cannot tell you off the top of my head. But go to the Large Hadron Collider website after you hear this show, and seriously, just look at the photos. Don't even look at the science. Just look at the photos and actually the mechanics of how it works. All those enormous, those big circular things that you'll see, they're giant rings of magnets and detectors. And the purpose of those is to find all the secondary stuff that comes out. It's all the stuff that decays. So when it decays, there's basically just a spray of other particles, which is the reason I can't give you an easy answer is it's not like, oh, it then turns into, you know, Higgs 2 and then Higgs 3. And
right. It's complicated.
Yeah, it's a whole complicated chain.
Of decay products.
Right. And the way that you know that this is a Higgs and not something else is that there's a very specific prediction of what it should decay into.
Right.
And then the fact that, again, you know, the fact that you verify it is kind of mind-blowing.
Right. So the answer to that question is go to the website.
And the answer is also I don't know.
Well, those are
yes.
good. Those both count as good answers. Now here's a science story that actually is pretty close to home. 2012 was the hottest year on record in the continental United States, and we of course had Hurricane Sandy, and that brought the whole issue of climate change sort of back onto the radar screen at least briefly. What other environmental problems is climate change causing around the world?
Well, so what it does is it tends to lead you to more extremes, and you know there's a classic problem every time there is an extreme drought or extreme heat wave or extreme cold snap, and people say, you know, is this global warming? Is this
right.
climate change? And you know the answer is you can never point to anyone and say yes, this is it. What you can point to is that statistically. With the Earth getting warmer, with climate patterns changing, you're going to get more and more extreme events, and that's what we see. So, you know, what you're seeing is entirely consistent with the predictions. But you know, then you get to that gotcha moment where somebody says, "Okay, so was this one it?" And the answer has to be, well, "I'll say it again. I don't know. you can't prove it, but certainly." The thing you can say unequivocally is that sea levels are rising around the globe.
Right.
And roughly half of it is because of melting ice. Actually, half of it is because the water is getting warmer and expanding. The oceans are actually expanding as they heat up. Well, that's just going to keep going. And so even if the weather didn't change at all, with the sea levels higher, you're going to have more coastal flooding everywhere around the world. Coastal flooding, as we've just seen, is a very, very expensive problem. So, you know, what is the cost of doing nothing and just letting this run its course? Well, you know, look at the cost of Hurricane Sandy. Now imagine, you know, you're just going to keep getting these different coastal cities around the world over and over again. So, you know, there's going to need to be adaptation, and we need to think then seriously about what can you do to affect this long-term warming trend.
Well, I have another question. This is actually a much less theoretical question than the bosun question from Amy in Manhattan, and she left this question on our show page. If so many of the microbes we carry are beneficial, are we killing some of the good ones off with the bad ones when we use hand sanitizers? Or doesn't it matter as much as the ones on our skin, maybe because we keep picking up new ones from our environment? She's saying, like, is the whole, you know, ubiquity of the Purell phenomenon a bad thing?
Fabulous question. Personally, I think it is. She actually got both parts of this right. The fact is, your hand gets repopulated all the time, and the bacteria that are on your hands are not really probably all that important to your overall biology. And so, on the whole, you're probably doing more good than bad by sanitizing your hands. The real risk is heavy dose of antibiotics internally. So for some people it's inevitable. If you have certain kinds of surgery or certain autoimmune diseases, you have to have these doses of antibiotics. And that's actually one of the ways that we know that when you lose these internal bacteria that it actually causes a lot of harm. So but the real abuser of antibiotics is the livestock industry, especially the poultry industry, where they just shovel antibiotics into these animals, it's doing two things. It's harming the health of the animal, and it's breeding these antibiotic resistant bacteria. So you're like you're knocking out the good, and you're fortifying the bad.
Right, right. Okay. Now here's a story that's been in the news a lot. That there have been studies, I guess, last year about older fathers possibly being responsible, I guess their genes or their genetic material being responsible for birth defects and specifically autism, which there's so much being written about. What do these studies really say? How much of it what are the statistics like, and how is the age of the father a factor? And how old, when we say an older father, How old are we talking about?
Yeah, I think I saw a lot of worried faces in certain parts of Brooklyn when that study came out of the gray dads with their 2-year-olds. These were two different studies, actually amazingly precise studies. They looked down to the sort of like, you know, the gene by gene, you know, DNA by DNA, strand by strand level of how many mutations there are in the DNA. A 70-year-old father passes on 8 times as many mutations as a 20-year-old father.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, you know, it's not a slight difference. It's a huge imbalance. The question is, of course, you know, what is that doing?
Right.
There is reasonably good evidence that older fathers pass along a higher risk of schizophrenia, mm-hmm. And possibly some other genetic diseases. The flip side of it is that, you know, mutations are also sources of genetic diversity.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in a sense, you know, as the average age of parenthood is going up, we're introducing more and more variation into the gene pool. And so, you know, it's really hard to say what that would do. You know, in some ways, you know, it's actually broadening the gene pool, but it's also, you know, opening up more potential for genetic disease.
Mm-hmm. Is there a final verdict on this, or is more to be studied, requires further study, or what are we feeling?
Well, I think if the question is, you know, should you not have kids over a certain age? I think, you know, the risk levels that we're looking at are still low enough that, you know, I wouldn't presume to interfere with somebody's personal decision. But I think we already know that, you know, that mothers over 40 have certain higher risks. And what we're seeing is, you know, that this it's not a that nature is not, you know, biased from one gender or the other. Older dads are introducing their own problems. The problem basically is that the sperm cells reproduce so rapidly. You know, men are always producing sperm, as we all have noticed. And the cells reproduce so rapidly that they're accumulating a lot of mutations. There's sort of just a lot of room for things to go wrong.
All right, I have one last question because I love this term. There was important research about sleep research last year. What is social jet lag? Explain to me what this concept is. I just want to use that term because I think it sounds cool.
So social jet lag is, you know, it's what we all experience it's a phenomenon of people who work on one schedule during the week, and then all of a sudden they sleep, they live on a totally different schedule over the weekend, or they do binge sleeping. You know, you sleep 12 hours one night so that you
right.
can go 2 nights of being you know with 3 hours of sleep so you can finish a project. And it turns out that, you know, sleep really doesn't average out. In fact,
right.
that just changing the hours of when you sleep has detrimental effects on all kinds of things, including obesity, including your resistance to disease. And I have to admit that I have not changed my behavior one bit on the basis of this study, but it is pretty unnerving to me.
And it's a cool term, social
yes.
jet lag. I've been speaking with Corey S. Powell, editor-at-large of Discover Magazine. We've been talking about the biggest science stories of 2012 on this week's Please Explain. And Corey, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you. This is a great discussion. I really appreciate it.